At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
Hi, I'm Kristen McGlory, lifelong genius hunter. For a decade, I've been unearthing the recipes that have changed the way we cook. Now, on the Genius Recipe Tapes, we go behind the scenes with the geniuses themselves. This week, I sat down with Brian Levy, who has accomplished something honestly extraordinary in his new cookbook, Good and Sweet. After working as a pastry chef for many years, he had started to get curious about if we truly needed sugar to make great desserts, when something like a perfectly ripe mango can be so sweet. And thanks to some creative thinking from Brian and a whole lot of trial and error, he developed a book full of sweet recipes that skip not only sugar, but any added sweeteners, which means no honey, no maple syrup, no stevia, just ingredients like fruit in all of its forms, and the natural sweetness of grains, nuts, even vegetables. As you can probably guess, it was not as simple as swapping out sugar one for one. Not even close. In our conversation, we will get into some of the genius workarounds he discovered. But first, we'll talk about a couple of fundamental tips and tricks that have stuck with Brian from early in his career.
I mean, this is just a basic, like, home kitchen, professional kitchen, anything. Like, when supplies are getting low, put them on a list. Put them on a shopping list. That's something that I used to not do at home for so long, and then I feel like it was more like in COVID when grocery shopping became so much more rare and important in that it was like our only source of food because we weren't going out. I just got into the practice of whenever anything's running low, just putting it on the shopping list.
Mm-hmm. You definitely won't remember later.
Yeah. No matter how much.
Guaranteed.
I at least think I'm going to. I won't. What else? There has to be something more fun. That it's better to do things right than to try to do them fast.
Oh.
I think a lot of people in the, at least in a professional kitchen, probably in a home kitchen, have the impulse to like whip things out quickly, especially in pastry related things, I think. Like where you're trying to roll things out neatly or cut things precisely. It's just better to do it slowly and make sure you're doing it correctly than to try to do it quickly. And eventually, with enough practice, you're going to do it quickly.
I also really loved how in the introduction to your new book, Good and Sweet, you talked about the differences between baking in a well-stocked kitchen at a restaurant versus your experience working on a farm in Catalonia. Could you tell us more about those two experiences?
Oh, gosh. Well, so after working at Babbo, I went directly to work on farms in Spain and France for 6 months. Do you know woofing?
It's like W-O-O-F. And what does that stand for again?
Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And you join like various geographic groups of woof. Basically, you get a listing for people that are willing to give you room and board in exchange for working on their farms. And the farms are varying levels of farminess. And so the second farm I went to in Spain outside of Barcelona, I only found out when I got there that they grew some Swiss chard, but that was it. Everything else we were going to be eating was from the grocery store dumpster. So I'm sure I was like a little horrified at first, but it actually became a really fun challenge. And my job basically was to make breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. And doing that with these very limited dumpster dived resources. Like when we had lots of apples, I made an apple tart that someone, like one of the friends of the owner of this place actually like came and bought one of these garbage apple tarts for his New Year's party. Anyway, obviously that's very different from being in like a Michelin starred kitchen where you have like access to anything and everything, which that's also a nice experience.
So do you feel like both of those things sort of combined in the work that you continue to do?
Yeah, because I guess the scarcity thing of the farm work, I like working within fixed parameters or with limits. I think it's kind of freeing for coming up with new things. Like when I was doing this book, it's obviously, there's obviously a big limitation I put on myself that opened up a whole new world of exploration of ingredients and techniques.
What was it that made you want to take on the huge challenge of creating a whole book without sugar, honey, any type of added sweetener in a baking book?
Well, I just thought it must be possible, and I found that it didn't seem to exist. So the must be possible thing came from just tasting a really sweet mango and thinking, this is so sweet and delicious. Like, surely I can make a dessert out of it without having to add sugar or honey or whatever. Like, why can't I just harness the sweetness that's in this mango? Because of the texture of mango, probably the first thing I thought of was making a custard. So I just based on a like simple creme brulee minus the brulee part, I adapted it using mango as the only thing sweetening it. And none of it is as simple as like replacing the sugar with a mango. It's not like that. Like I like cooked it down and cooked the whole cream and mango mixture down a bit to like condense it. Anyway, it turned out well. It was delicious. And I wanted to try out more recipes like that. And I actually looked for some like existing ones, and I really just didn't find any. I was kind of shocked because like, I don't know how many ideas haven't already been done. And I'm sure someone somewhere has done this, but I couldn't find any evidence of it. The closest thing that I could find was like a couple books from the maybe late 70s or 80s that were sweet things that were sweetened with fruit juice and concentrated fruit juice. And that wasn't at all what I wanted to do. I wanted fruits and other ingredients in as close to their like complete form to make their way into dessert dishes. So I started looking at, like after the custard, I tried cakes. I think I read in Alice Medrit's Flavor Flowers that I think she started testing Genoise cakes with all her different flowers to see how they would work. So I know I tried that and it didn't go very well because Genoise really depends on like the structure that that sugar provides and like how it helps the eggs keep their aerated structure. And so it really didn't go well. And when I kind of like discovered freeze-dried fruit, I thought, oh, maybe this is my answer. Like, because once I make it into a powder, it'll just be like, you know, a powder that's as easy to use as sugar, right? And of course it wasn't. Like, I think that's where I tried all the Genoise cakes, and they just turned into these like gummy, gross messes. And so in all these freeze-dried fruits that I was pulverizing, they have a lot of fiber in them, which obviously is not in sugar. And so that fiber was sucking up all the moisture from the other ingredients and just making these big, gloppy masses that you wouldn't want to serve as a cake. But one thing I learned that was like a big kind of turning point during the process of testing these recipes was when I figured out that if I coated the pulverized freeze-dried fruit in fat before incorporating it into a recipe, then it prevented that sucking up of all the moisture. So it could act more like a flour or a sugar within the recipe. And that's something I took from Rose Levy Barenbaum, no relation, who does the reverse creaming method for making cakes. She coats the dry ingredients in butter before adding the wet ingredients, which is the reverse of how most people make or made cakes before her. And the fat that coats the flour prevents the gluten from developing in the recipe. So I just took that and applied it to the fiber in the freeze-dried fruits, and it worked in helping to prevent the undesired texture that the fiber had been causing. So that was pretty cool.
That's amazing.
Hey, it's Kristen. We'll be right back.
And we're back with Brian Levy, author of Good and Sweet. The recipe development process must have been long and grueling for this book because you were doing such uncharted things. Are there any examples of like really big wins that you were so proud of after struggling to get something right, or really big failures that you just had to kind of like walk away from eventually?
An early success was when, so this is how long I've been working on this. My nephew just turned 7 and I made a cake for his first birthday.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it's actually in the book. It's his name's Hugo, and it's the Hugo cupcakes with chocolate frosting. I think that was one of the two first cakes that I figured out. I made the sticky toffee pudding, which has for a long time been one of my favorite desserts.
Mm-hmm. What are the keys to making those work?
In the sticky toffee pudding, so there's a basically a like stodgy cake with a sticky caramelly sauce on it.
And about the sweetest dessert I could imagine too.
Yeah.
So tricky.
But it does have dates in it to begin with, typically. And so I just like amped up the roll of the dates in it, and I made a puree of dates and of the dates and the butter and the eggs. And it becomes kind of this whipped puree, and that gets folded into the dry ingredients. And dates are like 2/3 sugar. And they have this caramelly kind of flavor, and relying on dates made me feel like I was cheating when I was working on the book. Like it was like I tried to avoid dates whenever possible because I didn't want it to just be like a date book. Mm-hmm. But because they're so sweet and sugary, it's easy to just and fairly neutral tasting. It's easy to go straight to them. But I wanted to make sure that all the sweet ingredients I was applying made sense in whatever recipe. Like if I was making an apple cake, I wanted to use dried apples, not dates. But in the sticky toffee pudding, it's all about caramel, brown sugary, buttery flavors. Dates make perfect sense. And then in the chocolate cake, I did a similar thing where it has a base of like a whipped dried fruit and other wet ingredients puree. And in that, I use prunes and dates. And that ended up having a really nice, I use prunes a lot with chocolate because I think it's a really good compliment. And in this particular cake, it's definitely a chocolate cake, but it has kind of hints of, have you ever had a Cadbury's fruit and nut bar?
Mm-hmm.
This cake kind of gives me that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Sort of like taking the best part of trail mix and expanding it. You know, like in a trail mix that has nut and fruits and you're always hunting for the chocolate chips, just like.
Yeah, exactly.
Drawing that out a little more.
Yeah. And then to have little kids like this stuff and, you know, just think of it as cake and not like healthy cake or Brian's weird cake. like when my friend was here last summer, I made those cupcakes. My friend's kid was like licking the frosting off the cupcake and loved it. And, you know. No one told her she had to eat it. It's just like, you know, when kids are eating stuff, they're not faking liking it. So
I can see how that would drive you to keep going with this project. If that was one of your early wins,
yeah,
that would light a fire for a while. Those sound amazing. I'd love to hear more, too, about what bakers can expect to be different about baking without sugar and sugar-ish ingredients.
So one of the things that sugar does is it melts. And when it melts, it spreads out. So when you're making cookies, conventional, you know, cookies with cane sugar in them, one of the things that's happening when you put those balls of dough on the pan and then put them in the oven is the sugar is melting. The butter and all everything else also, but the sugar is a big part of it spreading out. When you're using fruit ingredients instead of conventional sugars, one thing that all these fruits bring into the recipes is fiber. And the fiber kind of gives structure in its own way. And that's not a melty way. So you have to be more conscious of the shape you want things to end up being. Mostly when it comes to cookies, in wetter batters like cakes and muffins and things, you know, it all works itself out. But with drier dough like cookie dough, you have to give it more of its final shape because it's just not going to spread out the way it would if it had melting cane sugar in it.
Well, are there any other examples of ways in which you can expect baking to be different when you're not using sugar or other sugar-like ingredients?
You're going to think of things in a more deconstructed way. Mm. Like where in a conventional recipe, you might make a graham cracker crust by using store-bought graham crackers. Instead, I had to think of a way that would give you that same texture and flavor without the graham crackers that already have sugar in them. So I used a combination of breadcrumbs and date powder, which is also called date sugar, but I think it's a misnomer because it's whole dates that are dried and ground up. So I think it's just more marketable to call it date sugar because people like the sound of sugar, but it is date powder. I'm just trying to defend myself as not using like you don't want to put it in your coffee. It's not a sugar alternative. The breadcrumbs in place of graham crackers, I use that technique in the key lime tart and a cheesecake. I thought that was pretty exciting when I figured it out. There are other ingredients that I had never used before and some I had never even heard of before. I didn't know dried white mulberries at all. They're just a delicious thing to eat on their own, like as a snack, but they're also a pretty close relative of figs. And when you have that in mind, you can kind of taste the figginess of them. And it's like eating little shrunken figs that have kind of a slightly crunchy texture. But those are great for recipes that that have figs in them. I have a fig crumble where I use dried white mulberries in the streusel topping.
Yum.
There's a lot of use of coconut products because coconut milk, coconut meat, like coconut flakes, even coconut water, they just have a natural sweetness that doesn't necessarily overwhelm a recipe with a like bold coconut flavor, unless it's intended to. But other things like where garnishing is different. In conventional dessert making, there can be a lot of relying on like sprinkling powdered sugar over a cake or to make it pretty, or big crystalline sugar over a brioche or whatever. So I just figured out alternatives to that. Like in terms of adding crunch, I use nuts and puffed grains like millet. And then for more of like an aesthetic thing, I use bee pollen or non-fat dry milk powder or coconut flour, or a combination of those things. Non-fat dry milk powder is another like powerhouse ingredient that I use a lot in the book.
How
and
so?
I did come up with a vegan alternative, but The non-fat dairy milk powder, did you ever have Carnation instant breakfast?
Mm-hmm.
I did, and I always loved it. And it just has that like kind of malty flavor, the like dried milk that actually comes from the changing the state of the milk. And obviously it gets heated and to dry it out. It actually transforms or alters the flavor molecules in it. So it actually is bringing out like vanillin and those like warm malty flavors that you don't get in fresh milk. And the sugar that's in it is mostly lactose, which is less sweet than sucrose and the other sugars. But so it's bringing sweetness. It can kind of act as like an emulsifier, and just aesthetically, it's a nice like powder to have on hand for finishing things.
So where would, like, what are some of the recipes in your book where that features prominently?
So there are chocolate buckwheat cookies where that's sprinkled on top before they're baked.
I love that. I never would have thought to use it as a garnish.
Like something deep in me says like milk powder is not like a, it's like a processed thing that you shouldn't be using, but there are plenty of organic options out there. People have been drying milk and using it for a long time. So it's not just like an industrial age kind of nasty powder.
It makes so much sense to, like, fresh milk is so perishable, and this is a way to preserve it. And like when I was growing up, my aunt and uncle always, that was all their milk. They reconstituted dry milk just as kind of a practicality, as a cost savings. But it's really interesting to think that that product can be used to make your baked goods just taste better. Was there anything else that you wanted to be sure to mention that we hadn't talked about? And if not, I would just love to hear any parting thoughts about, you know, the most important things that you hope bakers take away from this book.
I wanted to be clear that there's no, like, I didn't come up with a like sugar alternative and just swap it in for sugar for all the in a bunch of recipes. Like, each recipe I had to approach as a new experiment, and the ingredients that sweeten it are ingredients that complement the flavors that are in it and make sense as part of the recipe. So there's no one size fits all sweetener that I use.
Thanks for listening, and my thanks to Brian Levy for sitting with me for this episode. Be sure to check out his cookbook, Good and Sweet, A New Way to Bake with Naturally Sweet Ingredients, which is officially out July 26th. This week's episode was put together by me, Kristen McGlory, executive producer Harry Sultan, with post-production by Crutchface Studios. If you have a favorite recipe with dates or milk powder or other secret superstars of the baking world, I would love to hear about it at genius@food52.com or by tagging me on Instagram @McGlorious. And if you like the Genius Recipe Tapes podcast, the very best thing that you can do to support us and to help other people find our show is to take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and a review. Or just send this episode to someone who would appreciate the magic that can come from fruit and nothing but the fruit. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.